Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we are getting through the Constitution. We just wrapped up Article 1, Section 9, and diving into Article 1, Section 10. And we do have Paul back with us, who actually kind of helps bring this into more a reasonable understanding. So, Paul, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm here.
And so we just got into, you just had time to read Article 1, Section 10, the very first part, subsection.
Right.
Okay. So.
Right. We were talking about that Section 10 is limitations on the states. So no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation. You got this marked with the highest alert. All right. And so we've got a couple of things happening. One of them, I think you've heard of national popular vote.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And that sounds to me like a kind of alliance. Now, if we wanted to have a popular vote, the Constitution requires us to have to do and go through the amendment process.
Yep.
You know, Article 5.
Yep.
Right. But what they're trying to do is an end run, which isn't, I'm always amazed at the brilliance of the founders, because the states are not allowed to enter into any treaty or alliance, which is what national popular vote is.
So let me ask you this. Have you heard of the Paris Accord?
Yes, I have heard of the Paris Accord.
How many states have signed up in compliance to the Paris Accords?
Well, if they've signed up in compliance to the Paris Accords, they have not signed up in compliance to the Constitution. I don't know how many there are.
Well, okay, so the Paris Accords is something that just recently happened. And if you actually look it up, and by all means, feel free to Google, the Paris Accord was a global meeting regarding climate change, CO2, and, creating a Green New Deal. And mm-hmm. So all of these countries, kind of went there and, many of them signed up. Well, the United States, if you look it up, I'm not sure who, what presidency or who was in office at the time, but they didn't sign up. And I think it may have been Trump, but go ahead.
I know Trump. Actually, I think Obama signed up and I think Trump pulled out.
Well, so here's the thing. First off, I think they signed up, but they didn't sign it as a treaty. First off, they didn't get I don't think Obama actually went through 2/3 of the Senate to sign it off, because I don't think the votes were there. And secondly, they don't have the authority. In other words, it's not within the enumerated powers, so they can't sign into an agreement that is not in their authority. That's the supremacy clause right there. All treaties which made or which shall be made under their authority. In other words, they have to have the authority via an enumerated power to enter into that accord.
Right.
So in other words, Obama actually committed treason by going and signing us up for, that agreement.
Sure. So I looked it up, okay? As of 22 April 2016, the United States, and that was still in the Obama administration, right? The United States had signed on to the Paris Accords.
Okay.
Okay? So that was...
treaty? Look up and see while you're doing that. Look and tell me if Obama signed that up as a treaty, or just I'm the president and I'm committing us to this agreement. Because I believe it was literally just that. He committed us in a role and capacity he had no authority to do. Nor did the Senate have the authority to actually even ratify a treaty like that. And so while you're looking that up, this kind of goes to that one petition we have, which is petition number two, that talks about the constitutionality of treaties, that the federal government cannot just go out there and create treaties under, you know, whatever they want to do. We covered this in the ratification debate. They can only make treaties regarding the enumerated powers we gave them. They cannot subjugate us to, you know, another group of nations, laws, or what have you. It's one thing if we were at the end of war and in the terms of war because we lost or something. I mean, that's one thing. But to just go and give away or subjugate us to a foreign law or foreign polity, they can't do that.
Right. Okay, so apparently, I'm not sure if it's it, although ordinarily COP, which is related to the Paris Accords, are not legally binding the Article 4 provisions of ICTU, and accounting provide that parties are to act in accordance with relevant COP decisions, okay. Technically decisions of the Conference of Parties. However, it also says the United States withdrew from the agreement in 2020, but rejoined in 2021.
Right. So, in other words, Biden equally committed treason. Folks, I mean, if you're keeping track out there, you know, this is treason. You know, in the railroad, they have this term called Gandhi dancing. And in the, I guess, kind of crude way, you know, there's this concept of dancing at the end of the rope. And if you look at, you know, the consequences of treason, what should happen when somebody commits treason is what? What's the, I mean, I don't think we covered that yet. I believe it's coming up in article. Actually, have we covered treason and the consequences of treason?
I don't think we have.
I don't think we have either. But you know what the consequences are, right? If a person is convicted, they are to be hanged.
Okay.
And so, I mean, they had zero compassion for that. I mean, in creating the Constitution, they wanted to make sure somebody that was really out there committing treason. Now, Washington clearly had some compassion for this misplaced rebellion against, you know, the whiskey tax, as we kind of covered that. But, you know, what these guys have done, Obama, there's no doubt in my mind, these guys would be based on the true definition and how they've pounded this out. Oh, yeah. Obama and all of these guys that had committed, outright committed treason. In other words, you know, when we get into this, folks, it requires the witness of two people. Well, when you've got it on video, when you have it on video, the whole world can actually witness exactly what they did and said.
Right.
And they've actually come along after the fact and even admitted that that's what they've done. And they, you know, and they've claimed that they had the authority. So it's that easy of a case to say, look, these guys don't have the authority. Because this is how the Constitution defined, you know, the parameters or the threshold for a treaty. They had to have the authority to do it.
Right. And it had to be within the delegated enumerated powers.
Right. So anyway, I'm people out there, because I know there's really bright people out there taking notes.
Yeah.
So with that, I'm sorry for the rat hole. We're focused back on this whole no state shall enter into treaty, alliance, or confederation. So, and I mentioned yesterday before we, you know, ended the show that at the very bottom, the very last part of Article 10 or Section 10, Article 1, they kind of go into more details where we talked about the need for, you know, a state reacting and being able to go and engage in war or, you know, act upon the imminent dangers that they're being faced. So that right there kind of couples with this concept that no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, or enter into any agreement or compact with another state, or with a foreign power, or engage in war. And so anyway, all right, so we kind of covered the front and the back part of Section 10. The next one, grant letters of marque and reprisal. What's that?
You've got that in black, because I don't know that we've been doing that. I don't think the states have actually done anything like that. Do you?
So what is a letter of marque?
Well, isn't it where you, let's say, like, I think what Jefferson did was that he didn't necessarily conscript, but he had privateers help us fight the pirates. So he actually had a bounty on pirate ships because we didn't have much of a navy. So if we had, you know, the government gave authorization for privateers to engage in war for the benefit of the United States.
But
is that right?
Yeah, but a letter of marque is something very specific, right? It's not just a bounty on, you know, a person. You know, it's so a letter of marque allows them to what? Confiscate, right?
Okay.
So in other words, no state. Go ahead, keep going.
I'm sorry. When I said bounty, I guess that's what I thought. I didn't clarify that. I was thinking confiscate.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
That's what it means then.
Correct. So a letter of marque is where you basically open it up. And, you know, in the old days, a letter of marque made it open so that if you had a ship and you saw a ship flying under the flag of a country, so let's say the United States created a letter of marque with Britain right after the war, and basically just told all U.S. Ship captains that you could go and seize and confiscate any ship out there flying under a British flag. And so what that did was it made it legal. It made piracy legal.
Huh?
In other words, it legalized piracy because who was able to keep the ship? Who? In other words, you took property away from either whoever owned the ship or the government or what have you. You're taking that property. Who is confiscating and keeping that? So a state... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. So I'm not sure. Are you saying that they allowed the people who or the ship captains who acquired it to keep it?
Yes. Yeah, that was the whole point. I mean, the government itself didn't necessarily process those things that they didn't want. It was about harassing and being able to frustrate and or take away the operations of their commerce, so forth, right? I mean, if you look at a letter of marque, it's not necessarily engaging in war. It's a confiscation of property.
Oh, so states then are doing that.
So here's the question. Now we're talking about states having the authority to grant letters of marque. Do the states, have the states ever granted letters of marque to basically seize property for whatever purpose?
Technically, there is something called asset forfeiture.
Uh-huh.
States have been actively engaged in it, and police departments admit to actually brag about it. So
yes,
let's say you got something that a piece of paper that authorizes a police department or some kind of even statute authorizes a police department to take property because some condition. you find some weed in somebody's home. And it, this happened, okay? 14-year-old kid has some marijuana in the house. They take the family home.
Yep. So, okay?
So it's they take property, they take cars, they take without just compensation. So not only are they violating that part, but what you're saying is that states have been granting letters of marquee, right?
Yep. And getting away with it. Yes, yes. And wow. And because the federal government's been doing it too.
Sure.
How many assets have they taken?
Oh, they do that all the time.
Right. See, it's wow. not just about a marquee against a nation, because, okay, they're placing context to a crime. Well, hold on here. Does the federal government have the ability to wage war on drugs?
They don't have that authority.
Why?
In fact, first of all, the federal government only has a few specific crimes specified in the Constitution. Anything else should be left to the states, right?
Okay, I'm following you. But okay. Why not a war on drugs? Because, see, war is a very specific thing. It's a nation against a nation.
Sure, and drugs are not a nation.
There you go. Right. It may be an idea. It's like a war on Christianity.
So a war on a concept never ends. In other words, what do you define? You know, how do you define this thing? And by the way, the war on drugs has never ended.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
You find a way to declare a war on something that is so undefined that you can spend money on it indefinitely.
Right.
Just what has been happening.
And war you can drugs. Make money on it as well. In other words, you become a real benefactor by creating war and taking people's stuff.
Right.
And so you start with that. Oh, well, you know, yeah, we need to do that because people just really hate drugs. I mean, we all should hate drugs, but, you know, we seem to be okay with pharmaceutical companies.
Right. Uh-oh.
Right? And, people talk about how insidious heroin and these, you know, these drugs and people that are, you know, manufacturing these things for people to get high on. Now as repugnant as it is, because I talk about this, and actually I just recently used this in a Feedback Friday, where I talked about the importance of discipline and putting aside, you know, our carnal desires, you know, for the betterment of society, to say, you know, constantly being fixated with our addictions and feeling good is a greater detriment to our society for enlightenment purposes, right? So,
sure.
But it's one thing to say, you know, we find that reprehensible and that, you know, engaging in that reprehensible, but it's another thing to say thou shalt not and or we will do these things to you. In other words, we have to get to a point where we've educated our way to doing the right thing instead of compelled and punished. I mean, it's that stick and carrot thing, right? Okay. We have to use a carrot to lead society down the path of enlightenment. You can't use a stick to do that. You'll never get to enlightenment with a stick. People right. have to start realizing how much better off they are by living better. You know, I mean, okay. make those laws. But some people get into a point where they just take this destructive path. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, when we look at it, and this is really getting into, like I said, societal enlightenment and so forth. But when we really start looking at it, there are actual professions out there that make a lot of money off of this concept of debasing society. You know, the pharmaceutical companies, you know, a psychiatrist seems like it's a very noble profession. But, I mean, when you really think about a psychiatrist, the psychiatrist that's actually curing people is not a success. I mean, they're not making money.
Okay.
Because
they
make money by keeping your butt in the seat, right?
Right. And prescribing strong drugs.
Yes. Absolutely correct. So as we, you know, start looking and peeling everything back, a letter of marque is where the government actually allows pirating, privateer efforts in taking and or in this particular case, when they create a little army and they actually go out and do that for the benefit of the state. And so right. States aren't supposed to be doing that. And yet they do. And
right.
They do it with their own people. I mean, in context, at this point in time, it was only really something that was applied to, you know, foreign nations, you know, nations that flew with this flag, you could go after them. You know, it's open season because we're not only at war, but, you know, anybody and everybody that can take advantage of this opportunity. This is one of those things that was a part of Britain's philosophy and how they trodden on, you know, those who, you know, crossed them. I mean, look at the time when Britain was running opium into China. And we're talking, I think this is in the 1600s, when they were running opium into China, trading opium for tea. And the Chinese said, no, you know, this is bad stuff. This is killing us. We want you to give us silver, pay us silver for the tea. And they actually used guns and went up their, you know, their rivers and so forth and destroyed, you know, killed people and destroyed the buildings along the river. I mean, this was good old Britain.
This is what Great Britain did.
Yes, this is what Great Britain did. Yeah.
Instead of giving them silver, I mean, instead of giving them a reasonable exchange,
which is what they were seeking, instead of this evil, you know, disease that they were feeding them, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so, and Britain took offense of being asked for silver and went to war with them.
Yeah, so. You know, we can learn a lot from history, and you can actually tell that China did too.
Mm-hmm.
Running fentanyl into America is exactly what Britain did to them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, anyway, we're running low on time. We're going to be going into the break. So the next thing that we have here is coining money, emitting bills of credit. So, in other words, let me ask you this. Can a state coin money or create bills of credit? In other words, you know, like printing money. Can they print or create coins or money?
This seems to prohibit states from printing or coining money.
But correct me if I'm wrong. Aren't there states out there that, you know, are actually going down the path of making their own coins?
I believe that there are.
Interesting. So how is that possible?
It's not constitutionally allowed. You know, the coining of money is specifically supposed to be a federal role, a responsibility.
Right. And we actually covered this in great detail because I made sure I highlighted focusing for the digital currency as, you know, the threat for the year. Because every year I actually go through and I make some changes and highlight, you know, like a while ago when it was impeachment and trying to impeach President Trump. A couple years ago, I focused on impeachment. Well, this past year, I really focused on the currency stuff. So we're going into break and we'll have to pick this back up on the other side of the break. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, one has to question whether a state actually has the constitutional grounds to be able to actually coin their gold and silver coins. We'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so, Paul, you know, looking at this once again, we know that there are states out there, and I believe Wyoming just passed a law where they're going to create their own gold credit or gold coin or something like that. And I'm going, why? Why are they doing that? I can understand the fact that the federal government's not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what your job as a state is to make sure that the federal government does their job instead of just correct. Saying, okay, well, if you're not going to do it, then we'll do it. I'm sorry. Correct. You're actually being constrained not to do it here. So you can't do it. You have to make them do it. Even though we correct. All know it's the best thing for us is to have a gold and silver species as our currency. Well, those who understand this, you know, those who understand this whole concept of property and the true value of property. So anyway.
Right.
Any
hey,
other,
before we get from it, real quick, I want to address this gold and silver thing a little more. But before we get away from it, we talked about letters of marque. But not reprisal.
Okay.
Can you address that?
Go ahead.
Okay. I was looking it up. Let me tell you what I found. It says explaining that letters of marque were authorizations for privateers to use force to harass or prey upon a nation's enemy, and that reprisal was, quote, the legally authorized act of securing redress for a debt incurred by a foreign government by forcibly taking the private property of its subjects. End quote.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So it sounds like what we talked about, but I don't think we specify. We talked about letters of marque, but we didn't specify reprisal, and I didn't want to get away from that.
That's okay.
Before we'd gone.
It's all kind of under that same umbrella where, right. you know, they're basically using, you know, not necessarily killing people, but they're just robbing them of their property.
Right.
Right.
Okay. And so... this thing about, let me see.
What?
Oh. So there's something else that came up. This is interesting. It came up in the Missouri legislature this year. This is talking about gold and silver. Uh-huh. Okay. And that was, when I saw this, I thought it was interesting. But there was a proposal in the legislature to make gold and silver legal tender. And I don't know. Maybe what they should have done was declare gold and silver legal tender, because it already says no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts.
Right. So,
why would we go through either the motions or whatever we did to make gold and silver legal tender?
Right. So actually what they should do is they should outlaw all of the forms of legal tender that have been inflicted upon us, such as electronic credit, right? Can you use a credit card to actually pay for things? Boy, I tell you what, that sure is convenient. I mean, every American today would actually, you know, be happy to fold and tear the Constitution so that they could continually live on credit and not have to carry around money.
Right.
right? But, you know, when you really think about it, we wouldn't have to carry around thousands and thousands of dollars just to do, you know, a day's, you know, a month's worth of shopping at the grocery store if they actually right. maintained gold and silver species, because we wouldn't have such an inflated currency, because inflation occurs based on the amount in circulation. So when you have right. the ability to double the paper in circulation for all of the different bills out there, that means mm-hmm. you basically devalued your currency in half, because you've created a greater presence. You've doubled the amount of bills in currency. So inflation has everything to do with, you know, what do we call it? It's not currency. It is in circulation. How many bills are in circulation? So what happens is the federal government prints money, and they give it to banks or the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. They print all of this money, and it goes into a bank. Does that mean that the money's in circulation?
Not yet,
but as soon as that bank actually starts, so he who actually dumps the money reaps the greatest reward, because as they start dumping the money, they dump that money at the full value of the face value of that currency at that time. As they start putting more and more money into circulation, it begins to devalue.
Right.
It takes a little time. You know, it takes a little time for the grocery stores and everybody to make adjustments to their cost of cars, to the cost of food, to the cost of your consumables, because it seems like more and more people have that money. So right. inflation has everything to do with the amount of money in circulation. And so if you had gold and silver, one, you're not replacing it all the time, nor do you have the ability to just inject more gold. That gold has to come from somewhere. You just can't print it.
Right.
Right. So anyway, I mean, we have the ability to take this entire system back, but the problem is that there's way too many people that really do enjoy going around cashless.
Yes.
Okay. So the next one, coin a tender in the payment of debt. Okay, so the next one is pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts.
Okay. Now, can we take this backward for a minute?
Sure.
What kind of law would impair the obligation of contract? In other words, you and I have a right to contract with each other to do something. Okay. What currently going on today would negatively affect that?
You know, so there's all sorts of, you know, like labor laws that would affect the ability of a contract.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
I mean, there's all sorts of things that you can create laws for that would create, you know, that would impair the obligations of the contract. So states aren't supposed to pass any laws that do that. And but it happens. They do this. And as a matter of fact, they create bills of attainder. You already know they do bills of attainder. We covered this. It's like, you know, demanding that everybody get a vaccination. That would be a bill of attainder. Or, you know, it's not allowing Christianity, you know, or Christ or anything like that to be mentioned or taught in school when other religions are.
Correct.
So those are ideologically, or I should say, those are not theoretically, those are examples of bills of punishment, where sure. you actually allow, you know, something to be done, to, you know, for one class, but you don't allow it for another group, demographic, what have you. Ex post sure. facto laws. So ex post facto laws are laws that basically take something that was legal and now make it illegal. and laws impairing the obligation of contracts. So when you look at how, because I'll give you a good example, the federal government had done this, where they inject into contracts and they actually make it so, like, when Chrysler went bankrupt under the Obama administration, when Chrysler went bankrupt, what should have happened?
Their assets should have been sold and they went away.
Well, and the bondholders should have been paid.
Okay, right.
Right? I mean, so there's this whole process of what was supposed to follow, of the obligations of that contract. And then they created a law that basically, you know, actually hurt those people who were protected and allowed, you know, this company to be sold for pennies on the dollar to fiat.
To a foreign company?
To a foreign company, yes. Mm. Under Obama. So anyway, the states have done this too. And can I give you an example? This is one of these, this right here is one of the laws that, you know, John Rowland had identified. I basically just, you know, kind of rubber stamped it. But there's no doubt in my mind, states all the time try to step in and, you know, step in behalf and or in favor of a larger company or larger corporation, somebody that's bringing more money in and so forth. And so this is the corruption of our laws and how they are protecting certain players, because those players are lining their pockets and keeping them in office. I'll give you a good example on the insurance industry and the obligations of insurance. When a state, because the state of Washington and many states have, I don't know if you've understood this, but many states have not necessarily declared, but they have actually implemented laws that are no-fault insurance. In other words, they had, and everybody that had a policy had a, you know, a fault insurance. Sure. And in other words, if you're at fault, you had to pay. If you're not at fault, then you don't have to pay for your deductible, these types of things. And so states, there are several states, and like I said, Washington State was one of those states that didn't become a no-fault insurance. They implemented laws to do that. And so in a way that law actually impaired the obligation of the contract, because the insurance company now no longer had to, you know, cover your deductible. Because if you're involved in an accident that sure smells like a no-fault accident, like any accident in an intersection based in the state of Washington, you know, because both parties were in the intersection, they consider it a no fault where everybody has to cover their own deductible. Well, hold on here.
Right.
How did that happen? You know, clearly somebody had to be at fault. And they actually went down this path, because I know, because it happened to me. And I said, hold on here. How is it that I have to pay my deductible? The contract says if I'm not at fault, I don't have to pay it. Well, we now look at if that person made it into the intersection and you hit them, even though they didn't have the right of way and they violated the law to get in there, now I have to pay my own deductible. And I'll tell you what, because that one personally affected me. But bottom line, how is that law not, you know, basically impairing the obligation of the contract?
Sure. Understood. Yeah.
Right. And so the reason that they're doing this is to basically so that the insurance companies don't have to spend as much money. Everybody has to pay their deductible. Then, you know, what's the point?
Right. Wow. So it's almost like it's kind of a
You probably thought I couldn't come up with an example, but I mean, anyway, that's just an insurance. There's all sorts of ways that they get involved to favor somebody.
It's almost like a per accident bailout for the insurance companies.
Yes, absolutely. Wow. Right. Because, I mean, let's say your deductible is $500. Well, okay, but $500 adds up.
It does.
Right. That means that, you know, even though you should have had to pay, and guess what? Now, because it's a shared fault, your rate goes up too.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yep. And, you know, in other words, the consumer, excuse the expression, folks, gets screwed. It's just that simple. Anyway, the final line here, because we already kind of covered everything else, the final line here is grant any title of nobility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does the state grant a title of nobility?
Well, again, you might come up with an example. You've got this highlighted.
Yeah. So there's the National Bar Association, and each state has their own bar.
Wow.
In other words, you have to pay in our club to be able to practice law in our courts, in our legal system. How is, by the way, let me ask you this. How is that relevant in common law?
So that's interesting. You know, I mentioned something about earlier about class system, and maybe that wasn't the right word. But, you know, it's almost like we have a two-tiered system in America, because there is what I'd call a legal class. That is, you've got, for example, let's say I wanted to run for attorney general. You know what one of the qualifications are? I have to be a bar attorney.
And how many people were bar attorneys or even had a JD that was a Supreme Court justice? Or, I mean, Madison didn't even have a JD.
Right.
He got an honorary JD from Princeton later on in life.
Right.
And yet I think he represented himself legally. And he represented others. I mean, back in those days, you know, anybody could represent other people.
Sure.
So
in fact, I guess you're supposed to have your choice of counsel, right?
Uh-huh. Yes. And so, they tell you that only a fool has himself as a client, right? Or something like that.
Yeah. The term is, if you represent yourself, you got a fool for a client, a jackass for a client, and a fool for a lawyer. That's how it goes.
Okay, all right, I buy that, but I don't buy that as really legitimate.
Sure, I don't either. But we have, when we were reading the ratification debates, a lot of these people were lawyers. A lot of them were attorneys, okay? And it could be, is it possible they could have been bar attorneys since you know, they were, before the revolution, they were English subjects, right?
Yeah, so I don't think the British bar at that point in time, the British accredited the registry. I'd have to look at the history, but I don't think they were established in the colonies at that point. And I mean, they may have been in the colonies, but when we severed that, I think everything was severed. And we went back to basic common law. And, you know, we didn't go down the path of creating the American, the AIR or whatever, right?
Ah, the American Bar Association.
Oh, yeah. We didn't create our own. Right.
Huh. Okay. You're probably right.
Which kind of speaks to the problem I've been, you know, kind of communicating, that everybody likes referencing Blackstone and, you know, Blackstone's view on the law. And it's nice to get an insight regarding Britain and, you know, that paradigm of common law under the monarchy. But common law under the Constitutional Republic is completely different, and somebody else really needed to dive into and kind of create that guide that Blackstone did for America. But that never happened.
Yes. You know, kind of like Webster did for the American Dictionary of the English Language. You know what? The ABA was the American Bar Association was founded in August
21, 1878. Yes, 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 yes. So, but that was founded after the British Bar Association, and it's a part of that.
Okay.
Because the American Bar, so what does that bar stand for? The American British Accredited Registry.
Right.
That's all it is just put an A bar. In, you know, if you acronym it, it would be A bar.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. Mm.
So in other words, we didn't create the R. The American,
We didn't create
it was ours, it would have been the AAR, the American Accredited Registry.
American Accreditation Registry, right.
Not accreditation. If you really look up the bar acronym, it's accredited. It's an old English, that's how they pronounced it back then. They maintained the name.
Right. Okay.
Anyway, the only reason I know this, folks, is because I was actually including these because I wanted to cover the actual facts in the why counties matter most. So it was important enough to kind of cover that. So back to the Constitution, though. So the states weren't supposed to create their own state bars either. So we have the American bar and then we have the state bars.
Okay.
And so it's interestingly enough, the state bar is not, you know, like the California bar is not the California American bar. It is the California bar.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
In other words, they're all underneath the British umbrella. It's not like they really severed anything. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So The next subsection, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties or imports or exports except that which may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspections and the net produce of all duties and imposts laid by any state on imports or exports shall be for the use of the Treasury of the United States, and all such laws shall be subject to the revision and control of the Congress.
Mm.
So what is this? What are they basically saying? That no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports.
So this isn't between the states. Imports or exports is
imposts. Well, so actually it is. So actually this is a impost or so it is a duty and or an impost on imports or exports in and out of a state, because bottom line, if a state, New York, all the coastal states would have these ports of entry, sure, for commerce. Now, in Mexico, or I should say in Texas, California, there are these ports of entry where commerce, you know, comes from south of the border or north of the border. There's these ports of entry where commerce flows. And it usually flows, you know, in the channels of distribution, the lanes of distribution that are most efficient, the way corporations want to do this. So what ends up happening is that port in New York, Norfolk, whatever, you know, creates these, you know, piers and moors and, you know, wharfs and so forth to be able to bring this commerce in. Mm-hmm. And so when they do that, they have to lay some type of impost, or, you know, to build the, you know, the growth, and to be able to maintain and sustain and continue to keep up the growth as the demand increases as well. So the question is, can a state legitimately create an impost or a tax to help pay, you know, on the goods coming in, to help pay for the maintenance, the throughfare, you know, to the wear and tear that's being done in that area, just going over the roads and so forth? Absolutely. But as it says here, you know, because it says absolutely necessary, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws and, you know, of bringing stuff in, period. So the next one actually kind of helps people understand that no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war or in peacetime, or enter into any other agreement. But bottom line, this right here is designed to make sure that the ports of entry and the states that, you know, host them cannot take advantage by making money off of the interior states. Only what is necessary. Go ahead.
As a matter of fact, if they make money off of it, it appears that it's going to go for the benefit of the United States. Right? Hang on. Absolutely. Excuse me. Duties. My screen just went off. Duties imposed laid by any state imports shall be for the use of the Treasury of the United States.
Okay. Right. And the net produce of all duties and imposts laid by any state or imports or exports shall be for the use of the Treasury. So in other words, you're right. If there's any profit that they bring in, you know, the federal government can confiscate that. But the fact is that the federal government should not even put their hands on an export, because they're not to have or collect exports. Right. Okay. Taxes on exports.
So at one point earlier, we talked about duties on imports and exports, and that had to do with in and out of the country. And here we're talking about duties on imports and exports, and we're talking about within or between states.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So they're not to actually wage economic warfare to say we're going to make money off of, you know, these interior states or what have you. So the point is to make sure that everybody benefits in this relationship, not those who, just because you have a port of water or a port, you know, with Mexico, what have you, wherever a lot of the commerce flows. I mean, a lot of commerce flows through Texas. A lot of commerce flows through Texas in the same aspect of, you know, many of the ports on the seashore. All those trucks coming in, trains coming in, right? We've seen, do trains actually cross the border? Yeah, we've seen immigrants, or I should say invaders on them. We've just ran out of time. So, folks, we will get back. We just wrapped up, believe it or not, we just wrapped up Article 1. So tomorrow we're going to dive into Article 2, and this talks about the duties, roles, responsibilities, and powers of the President of the United States. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution donations page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.